He learned counting. He was certain this would be no problem. But after a few weeks, the way the numbers made truths about people's lives was interesting to him. He tried law, but kept beginning a duet with the jury. He found the stock market reminded him of a wriggling animal. God showed up at the workplace and stuck pins near his eyes. So the man sat in a chair. He went to a park and looked at people. A young woman was writing in her journal under a tree. She was writing and writing, and he caught her eye and sent her waves of company, and she kept his gaze and wrote more, looked up again, wrote more, circled his bench and sat down. And when she asked him questions, he said nothing but just looked at her, deep and real. And she stood and went away, got a drink at the drinking fountain, circled back. After an hour of this, she said, "Thank you," tears in her eyes, and left. The pathway of her feet looped to the bench and back and away and back, swirls and curls and lines. God was irritated. "Close your eyes," said God, shaking a bottle of pills like a maraca. The man's wife was unhappy. She was doing the cooking now, and her husband didn't move or speak anymore. She missed their discussions, his paintings, his stories, his pliés. She missed talking to him about her job with the troubled people, and how at certain moments there was an understanding held between her and the person sitting there, crying or not crying, mad or not mad, happy or unhappy, bland or lively, and it was like, at that moment, she said they were stepping all over a canvas together. It's like, she said, the room is full of invisible beetles or water or pillows or concrete. She told him all about it, and his eyes were closed, but she could feel from his skin that he was listening. She went to him and undressed him slowly, and they made love there on the sofa, and he hardly moved but just pressed his warmth to her, his body into hers, and she held him close, and the man gave her all he could without speaking, without barely shifting, lips and hips, and she started to cry. Afterward, she pressed her head to his chest and told him all the things she'd thought about, the particular flower he made her feel, the blade, the chocolate torte. They slept on the sofa together. God put the man in a box with no windows. He tied his hands behind his back and knotted a blindfold over his eyes. He stuck duct tape over his lips. God said, "Not a peep out of you. Don't you interact with anybody." The man sat with his head full of dreams. He thought of flying fish and the smell of his wife's skin, white powder and clear sweat. He thought of basil breaking open and the drawing of a tomato with red and black paint and the word tomato, consonant vowel, consonant vowel, consonant vowel, and the perfect taste of tomato with basil together, and the rounded curve of a man's back, buttons of spine visible. He wondered where the girl with the journal was right then. He thought of his wife making bridges of air over air. He listened to the sound of wind outside the box, loud and soft as his breath.
Neil Gaiman performs his story, Troll Bridge.
They pulled up most of the railway tracks in the early 60s, when I was 3 or 4. They slashed the train services to ribbons. This meant that there was nowhere to go but London, and the little town where I lived became the end of the line. My earliest reliable memory 18 months old, my mother away in hospital having my sister, and my grandmother walking with me down to a bridge and lifting me up to watch the train below, panting and steaming like a black iron dragon. Over the next few years, they lost the last of the steam trains, and with them went the network of railways that joined village to village, town to town. I didn't know that the trains were going. By the time I was 7, they were a thing of the past. We lived in an old house on the outskirts of the town. The fields opposite were empty and fallow. I used to climb the fence and lie in the shade of a small bulrush patch and read. Or if I were feeling more adventurous, I'd explore the grounds of the empty manor beyond the fields. It had a weed-clogged ornamental pond with a low wooden bridge over it. I never saw any groundsmen or caretakers in my forays through the gardens and woods, and I never attempted to enter the manor. That would have been courting disaster. And besides, it was a matter of faith for me that all empty old houses were haunted. It is not that I was credulous, simply that I believed in all things dark and dangerous. It was part of my young creed that the night was full of ghosts and witches, hungry and flapping, and dressed completely in black. The converse held reassuringly true. Daylight was safe. Daylight was always safe. A ritual. On the last day of the summer school term, walking home from school, I would remove my shoes and socks and, carrying them in my hands, walk down the stony, flinty lane on pink and tender feet. During the summer holiday, I would put shoes on only under duress. I would revel in my freedom from footwear until the school term began once more in September. When I was 7, I discovered the path through the wood. It was summer, hot and bright, and I wandered a long way from home that day. I was exploring. I went past the manor, its windows boarded up and blind, across the grounds and through some unfamiliar woods. I scrambled down a steep bank, and I found myself on a shady path that was new to me and overgrown with trees. The light that penetrated the leaves was stained green and gold, and I thought I was in fairyland. A little stream trickled down the side of the path, teeming with tiny transparent shrimps. I picked them up and watched them jerk and spin on my fingertips. Then I put them back. I wandered down the path. It was perfectly straight and overgrown with short grass. From time to time, I would find these really terrific rocks, bubbly, melted things, brown and purple and black. If you held them up to the light, you could see every color of the rainbow. I was convinced that they had to be extremely valuable, and I stuffed my pockets with them. I walked and walked down the quiet golden green corridor and saw nobody. I wasn't hungry or thirsty. I just wondered where the path was going. It traveled in a straight line and was perfectly flat. The path never changed, but the countryside around it did. At first, I was walking along the bottom of a ravine, grassy banks climbing steeply on each side of me. Later, the path was above everything, and as I walked, I could look down at the treetops below me and the roofs of occasional distant houses. My path was always flat and straight, and I walked along it through valleys and plateaus. And eventually, in one of the valleys, I came to the bridge. It was built of clean red brick, a huge curving arch over the path. At the side of the bridge were stone steps cut into the embankment, and at the top of the steps, a little wooden gate. I was surprised to see any token of the existence of humanity on my path, which I was by now convinced was a natural formation, like a volcano. And with a sense more of curiosity than anything else, I had, after all, walked hundreds of miles, or so I was convinced, and might be anywhere, I climbed the stone steps and went through the gate. I was nowhere. The top of the bridge was paved with mud. On each side of it was a meadow. The meadow on my side was a wheat field. The other field was just grass. There were the caked imprints of huge tractor wheels in the dried mud. I walked across the bridge to be sure. No trip trap. My bare feet were soundless. Nothing for miles. Just fields and wheat and trees. I picked an ear of wheat and pulled out the sweet grains, peeling them between my fingers, chewing them meditatively. I realized then that I was getting hungry and went back down the stairs to the abandoned railway track. It was time to go home. I was not lost. All I needed to do was follow my path home once more. There was a troll waiting for me under the bridge. "I'm a troll," he said. And then he paused and added, more or less as an afterthought, "Fall, roll, de roll, roll." He was huge. His head brushed the top of the brick arch. He was more or less translucent. I could see the bricks and trees behind him, dimmed but not lost. He was all my nightmares given flesh. He had huge, strong teeth and rending claws and strong, hairy hands. His hair was long, like one of my sister's little plastic gonks, and his eyes bulged. He was naked, and his penis hung from the bush of gonk hair between his legs. "I heard you, Jack," he whispered in a voice like the wind. "I heard you trip-trapping over my bridge, and now I'm going to eat your life." I was only 7, but it was daylight, and I do not remember being scared. It is good for children to find themselves facing the elements of a fairy tale. They're well equipped to deal with those. "Don't eat me," I said to the troll. I was wearing a stripy brown t-shirt and brown corduroy trousers. My hair also was brown, and I was missing a front tooth. I was learning to whistle between my teeth, but wasn't there yet. "I'm going to eat your life, Jack," said the troll. I stared the troll in the face. "My big sister is going to be coming down the path soon," I lied, "and she's far tastier than me. Eat her instead." The troll sniffed the air and smiled. "You're all alone," he said. "There's nothing else on the path. Nothing at all." Then he leaned down and ran his fingers over me. It felt like butterflies were brushing my face, like the touch of a blind person. Then he snuffled his fingers and shook his huge head. "You don't have a big sister. You've only a younger sister, and she's at her friend's today." "Can you tell all that from smell?" I asked, amazed. "Trolls can smell the rainbows. Trolls can smell the stars," it whispered, sadly. "Trolls can smell the dreams you dreamed before you were ever born. Come close to me, and I'll eat your life." "I've got precious stones in my pocket," I told the troll. "Take them, not me. Look." I showed him the lava jewel rocks I'd found earlier. "Clinker," said the troll, "the discarded refuse of steam trains, of no value to me." He opened his mouth wide, sharp teeth, breath that smelled of leaf mold and the underneaths of things. "Eat now." He became more and more solid to me, more and more real, and the world outside became flatter, began to fade. "Wait!" I dug my feet into the damp earth beneath the bridge, wiggled my toes, held on tightly to the real world. I stared into his big eyes. "You don't want to eat my life. Not yet. I'm only 7. I haven't lived at all yet. There are books I haven't read yet. I've never been on an aeroplane. I can't whistle yet, or not really. Why don't you let me go? When I'm older and bigger and more of a meal, I'll come back to you." The troll stared at me with eyes like headlamps. Then it nodded. "When you come back, then," it said, and it smiled. I turned around and walked back down the silent straight path where the railway lines had once been. After a while, I began to run. I pounded down the track in the green light, puffing and blowing until I felt a stabbing ache beneath my ribcage, the pain of stitch, and clutching my side, I stumbled home. The fields started to go as I grew older. One by one, row by row, houses sprang up with roads named after wildflowers and respectable authors. Our home, an aging, tattered Victorian house, was sold and torn down. New houses covered the garden. They built houses everywhere. I once got lost in the new housing estate that covered two meadows I'd once known every inch of. I didn't mind too much that the fields were going, though. The old manor house was bought by a multinational, and the grounds became more houses. It was 8 years before I returned to the old railway line, and when I did, I was not alone. I was 15. I'd changed schools twice in that time. Her name was Louise, and she was my first love. I loved her grey eyes and her fine light brown hair and her gawky way of walking, like a fawn just learning to walk, which sounds really dumb, for which I apologize. I saw her chewing gum when I was 13, and I fell for her like a suicide from a bridge. The main trouble with being in love with Louise was that we were best friends, and we were both going out with other people. I'd never told her I loved her, or even that I fancied her. We were buddies. I'd been at her house that evening. We sat in her room and played Rattus Norvegicus, the first Stranglers LP. It was the beginning of punk, and everything seemed so exciting. The possibilities in music, as in everything else, were endless. Eventually, it was time for me to go home, and she decided to accompany me. We held hands, innocently, just pals, and we strolled the 10-minute walk to my house. The moon was bright, and the world was visible and colorless, and the night was warm. We got to my house, saw the lights inside, and stood in the driveway and talked about the band I was starting. We didn't go in. Then it was decided that I'd walk her home, so we walked back to her house. She told me about the battles she was having with her younger sister, who was stealing her makeup and perfume. Louise suspected that her sister was having sex with boys. Louise was a virgin. Well, we both were. We stood in the road outside her house under the sodium yellow streetlight, and we stared at each other's black lips and pale yellow faces. We grinned at each other. Then we just walked, picking quiet roads and empty paths. In one of the new housing estates, a path led us into the woodland, and we followed it. The path was straight and dark, but the lights of distant houses shone like stars on the ground, and the moon gave us enough light to see. Once we were scared, when something snuffled and snorted in front of us. We pressed close, so it was a badger, laughed and hugged, and kept on walking. We talked quiet nonsense about what we dreamed and wanted and thought. And all the time, I wanted to kiss her and feel her breasts and maybe put my hand between her legs. Finally, I saw my chance. There was an old brick bridge over the path, and we stopped beneath it. I pressed up against her. Her mouth opened against mine. Then she went cold and stiff and stopped moving. "Hello," said the troll. I let go of Louise. It was dark beneath the bridge, but the shape of the troll filled the darkness. "I froze her," said the troll, "so we can talk. Now, I'm going to eat your life." My heart pounded, and I could feel myself trembling. "No. You said you'd come back to me, and you have. Did you learn to whistle? Yes? Oh, that's good. I never could whistle. It sniffed and nodded. I am pleased. You have grown in life and experience. More to eat, more for me. I grabbed Louise, a taut zombie, and pushed her forward. Don't take me. I don't want to die. Take her. I bet she's much tastier than me, and she's 2 months older than I am. Why don't you take her? The troll was silent. It sniffed Louise from toe to head, snuffling at her feet and crotch and breasts and hair. Then it looked at me. She's an innocent, it said. You're not. I don't want her. I want you. I walked to the opening of the bridge and stared up at the stars in the night. But there's so much I've never done, I said, partly to myself. I mean, I've never had sex, and I've never been to America. I haven't done anything. Not yet. The troll said nothing. I could come back to you when I'm older. The troll said nothing. I will come back. Honest, I will. Come back to me, said Louise. Why? Where are you going? I turned around. The troll had gone, and the girl I had thought I loved was standing in the shadows beneath the bridge. We're going home, I told her. Come on. We walked back and never said anything. She went out with the drummer in the punk band I started and, much later, married someone else. We met once on a train after she was married, and she asked me if I remembered that night. I said I did. I really liked you that night, Jack, she told me. I thought you were going to kiss me. I thought you were going to ask me out. I would have said yes if you had. But I didn't. No, she said, you didn't. Her hair was cut very short. It didn't suit her. I never saw her again. The trim woman with the taut smile was not the girl I had loved, and talking to her made me feel uncomfortable. I moved to London, and then some years later, I moved back again. But the town I returned to was not the town I remembered. There were no fields, no farms, no little flint lanes. And I moved away as soon as I could to a tiny village 10 miles down the road. I moved with my family, I was married by now, with a toddler, into an old house that had once, many years before, been a railway station. The track had been dug up, and the old couple who lived opposite us used it to grow vegetables. I was getting older. One day I found a grey hair. On another, I heard a recording of myself talking, and I realized I sounded just like my father. I was working in London, doing A&R for one of the major record companies. I was commuting into London by train most days, coming back some evenings. I had to keep a small flat in London. It's hard to commute when the bands you're checking out don't even stagger onto the stage until midnight. It also meant that it was fairly easy to get laid, if I wanted to. Which I did. I thought that Eleonora, that was my wife's name, I should have mentioned that before, I suppose, didn't know about the other women. But I got back from a 2-week jaunt to New York one winter's day, and when I arrived at the house, it was empty and cold. She'd left a letter, not a note, 15 pages, neatly typed, and every word of it was true, including the PS, which read, "You really don't love me, and you never did." I put on a heavy coat, and I left the house and just walked, stunned and slightly numb. There was no snow on the ground, but there was a hard frost, and the leaves crunched under my feet as I walked. The trees were skeletal black against the harsh grey winter sky. I walked down the side of the road. Cars passed me, travelling to and from London. Once I tripped on a branch half hidden in a heap of brown leaves, ripping my trousers, cutting my leg. I reached the next village. There was a river at right angles to the road and a path I'd never seen before beside it, and I walked down the path and stared at the partly frozen river. It gurgled and plashed and sang. The path led off through fields. It was straight and grassy. I found a rock half buried on one side of the path. I picked it up, brushed off the mud. It was a melted lump of purplish stuff with a strange rainbow sheen to it. I put it into the pocket of my coat and held it in my hand as I walked, its presence warm and reassuring. The river meandered away across the fields, and I walked on in silence. I had walked for an hour before I saw houses, new and small and square, on the embankment above me. And then I saw the bridge, and I knew where I was. I was on the old railway path, and I'd been coming down it from the other direction. There were graffiti painted on the side of the bridge. Fuck and Barry Loves Susan and the omnipresent NF of the National Front. I stood beneath the bridge in the red brick arch, stood among the ice cream wrappers and the crisp packets and the single sad used condom, and watched my breath steam in the cold afternoon air. The blood had dried into my trousers. Cars passed over the bridge above me. I could hear a radio playing loudly in one of them. "Hello?" I said quietly, feeling embarrassed, feeling foolish. "Hello?" There was no answer. The wind rustled the crisp packets and the leaves. I came back. I said I would. And I did. "Hello?" Silence. I began to cry then, stupidly, silently, sobbing under the bridge. A hand touched my face and I looked up. "I didn't think you'd come back," said the troll. He was my height now, but otherwise unchanged. His long gonk hair was unkempt and had leaves in it, and his eyes were wide and lonely. I shrugged, then wiped my face with the sleeve of my coat. "I came back." Three kids passed above us on the bridge, shouting and running. "I'm a troll," whispered the troll in a small, scared voice. "Fol roll deol roll." He was trembling. I held out my hand and took his huge clawed paw in mine. I smiled at him. "It's okay," I told him. "Honestly, it's okay." The troll nodded. He pushed me to the ground, onto the leaves and the wrappers and the condom, and lowered himself on top of me. Then he raised his head and opened his mouth and ate my life with his strong, sharp teeth. When he was finished, the troll stood up and brushed himself down. He put his hand into the pocket of his coat and pulled out a bubbly burnt lump of clinker rock. He held it out to me. "This is yours," said the troll. I looked at him, wearing my life comfortably, easily, as if he'd been wearing it for years. I took the clinker from his hand and sniffed it. I could smell the train from which it had fallen so long ago. I gripped it tightly in my hairy hand. "Thank you," I said. "Good luck," said the troll. "Yeah, well, you too." The troll grinned with my face. It turned its back on me and began to walk back the way I had come, towards the village, back to the empty house I had left that morning, and it whistled as it walked. "I've been here ever since, hiding, waiting, part of the bridge. I watch from the shadows as the people pass, walking their dogs or talking or doing the things that people do. Sometimes people pause beneath my bridge to stand or piss or make love. And I watch them, but say nothing. And they never see me. Fol roll de ol roll. I'm just going to stay here in the darkness under the arch. I can hear you all out there, trip-trapping over my bridge. Oh yes, I can hear you. But I'm not coming out.
Nathan Englander's For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, performed by Jefferson Mays.
The beds were to be separated on nights forbidden to physical intimacy. But Chava Bela hadn't pushed them together for many months. She flatly refused to sleep anywhere except on her menstrual bed and was, from the start, impervious to her husband's pleading. "You are pure," Dov Binyamin said to the back of his wife, who, heightening his frustration, slept facing the wall. "I am impure." "Well, this is not true, Chava Bela. It's an impossibility, and I know myself the last time you went to the ritual bath. A woman does not have her thing..." "Well, her thing?" Chava said. She laughed, as if she had caught him in a lie, and turned to face the room. "A woman doesn't menstruate for so long without even a single week of clean days. And a wife does not for so long ignore her husband. It's Shabbos, a double mitzvah tonight, an obligation to make love." Chava Bela turned back again to face her wall. She tightened her arms around herself as if in an embrace. "You are my wife," Dov Binyamin said. "That was God's choice, not mine. I might also have been put on this earth as a bar of soap or a kugel." "Better," she said, "better it should have been one of those." That night, Dov Binyamin slept curled up on the edge of his bed, as close as he could get to his wife. After Shabbos, Chava avoided coming into the bedroom for as long as possible. When she finally did enter and found Dov dozing in a chair by the balcony, she went to sleep fully clothed, her shaitel still on top of her head. As he nodded forward in the chair, Dov's hat fell to the floor. He woke up, saw his wife, picked up his hat, and brushing away the dust with his elbow, placed it on the nightstand. How beautiful she looked, all curled up in her dress. Like a princess enchanted, he thought. Dov pulled the sheet off the top of his bed. He wanted to cover her, to tuck Chava in. Instead, he flung the sheet into a corner. He shut off the light, untied his shoes, but did not remove them, and went to sleep on the tile floor beside his wife's bed. Using his arm for a pillow, Dov Binyamin dreamed of a lemon ice his uncle had bought him as a child, and the sound of the airplanes flying overhead at the start of the Yom Kippur War. Dov Binyamin didn't go to work on Sunday. Folding up his talis after prayers and fingering the embroidery of the talis bag, he recalled the day Chava had presented it to him as a wedding gift, the same gift his father had received from his mother and his father's father before. Dov had marveled at the workmanship, wondered how many hours she had spent with a needle in hand. Now, he wondered if she would ever find him worthy of such attentions again. Zipping the prayer shawl inside, Dov Binyamin put the bag under his arm. He carried it with him out of the shul, though he had his own cubby in which to store it. The morning was oppressively hot. Chamsin was settling over Jerusalem. Dov Binyamin was wearing his lightest kaftan, but in the heat wave it felt as if it were made of the heaviest wool. Passing a bank of phones, he considered calling work, making some excuse, or even telling the truth. Shy, he would say, I am a ghost in my home, and wonder who will mend my talis bag when it is worn. His phone card was in his wallet, which he had forgotten on the dresser, and what did he want to explain to Shy for, who had just come from a Shabbos with his spicy wife and a house full of children? Dov followed Jaffa Street down to the old city. Roaming the alleyways always helped to calm him. There was comfort in the Jerusalem stone, and the walls within walls, and the permanence of everything around him. He felt a kinship with history's Jerusalemites, in whose struggles he searched for answers to his own. Lately, he felt closer to his biblical heroes than to the people with whom he spent his days. King David's desires were far more alive to Dov than the empty problems of Shai and the other men at the furniture store. Weaving through the Jewish quarter, he had intended to end up at the wall to say Tehillim, and in his desperate state to scribble a note and stuff it into a crack, just like the tourists in their cardboard yarmulkes. Instead, he found himself caught up in the crush inside the Damascus Gate. An old Arab woman was crouched down behind a wooden box of cactus fruit. She peeled a sabra with a kitchen knife, allowing a small boy a sample of her product. The child ran off with his mouth open, a stray thorn stuck in his tongue. Dov Binyamin tightened his hold on the talis bag and pushed his way through the crowd. He walked back to Mea Shearim, along the streets of East Jerusalem. Let them throw stones, he thought, though no one did. No one even took notice of him except to step out of his way as he rushed to his Rebbe's house for some advice. Meir the beetle was in the front room, sitting on a plastic chair at a plastic table. Don't you have work today? Meir said, without looking up from the papers that he was shifting from pile to pile. Dov Binyamin ignored the question. Is the Rebbe in? He's very busy. Dov Binyamin went over to the kettle, poured himself a mug of hot water, and stirred in a spoonful of Nescafe. How about you don't give me a hard time today? Who's giving a hard time? Meir said, putting down the papers and getting up from his chair. I'm just telling you, Sunday is busy after a day and a half without work. He knocked at the Rebbe's door and went in. Dov Binyamin made a blessing over his coffee, took a sip, and, being careful not to spill, lowered himself into one of the plastic chairs. The coffee cut the edge off the heat that, like Dov, sat heavy in the room. The Rebbe leaned forward on his shtender and rocked back and forth as if he were about to topple. No, this is no good. Very bad. No good at all. He pulled back on the lectern and held it in that position. The motion reminded Dov of his dream, of the rumbling of engines and a vase, there had been a blue glass vase, set to rocking on a shelf. And you don't want a divorce? I love her, Rebbe. She's my wife. And Chavabela? She, thank God, has not even raised the subject of separation. She asks nothing of me but to be left alone. And this is where the serpent begins to swallow its tail. The more she rejects me, the more I want to be with her. And the more I want to be with her, the more intent she becomes that I stay away. She is testing you. Yes, in some way, Rebbe, Chava Bela is giving to me a test. Pulling at his beard, the Rebbe again put his full weight on the lectern so that the wood creaked. He spoke in a Talmudic sing-song. Then you must find the strength to ignore Chava Bela until Chava Bela should come to find you. And you must be strict with yourself, for she will not consider your virtues until she is calm in the knowledge that her choices are her own. But I don't have the strength. She's my wife. I miss her. And I am human too, with human habits. It will be impossible for me to try and not touch her, to try and convince her. Look, Rebbe, forgive me, but God created the world with a certain order to it. I suffer greatly under the urges with which I have been blessed. I see, said the Rebbe. The urges have become great, unbearable. And to be around someone that I feel so strongly for, to look and be unable to touch, it is like floating through heaven in a bubble of hell. The Rebbe pulled a chair over to the bookcases that lined his walls. Climbing onto the chair, he steadied himself, then removed a volume from the top shelf. We must relieve the pressure. Well, it is a fine notion, but I fear that it's impossible. I'm giving you a heter, the Rebbe said. A special dispensation. He went over to his desk and flipped through the book. He began to scribble on a pad of onion skin paper. For what? To see a prostitute. Excuse me, Rebbe? Your marriage is at stake, is it not? Dov bit at his thumbnail and then rushed the hand as if it were something shameful into the pocket of his kaftan. Yes, he said, a shake entering his voice. My marriage is a withered limb at my side. The Rebbe aimed his pencil at Dov. One may go to great lengths in the name of achieving peace in the home. But a prostitute? Dov Binyamin asked. For the relief of unbearable urges, the Rebbe said. And he tore, like a doctor, the sheet of paper from the pad. Dov Binyamin drove to Tel Aviv, the city of sin. There he was convinced he would find plenty of prostitutes. He parked his Fiat on a side street off Dizengoff and walked around town. Though he was familiar with the city, its social aspects were foreign to him. It was the first leisurely walk he had taken in Tel Aviv, and fancying himself an anthropologist in a foreign land, he found it all quite interesting. He was usually the one under scrutiny. Busloads of American tourists scamper through Meir Shalem daily. They buy up the stores and pull tiny cameras from their hip packs, snapping real pictures of live Hasidim, like the ones from the stories their grandparents told. Next time, he would say, boo! He laughed at the thought of it. Already, he was feeling lighter. Passing a kiosk, he stopped and bought a bag of pizza-flavored bisli. Then he reached the fountain. He sat down on a bench among the aged new immigrants. They clustered together as if huddled against a biting cold wind that had followed them from their native lands. He stayed there until dark, until the crowd of new immigrants, like the bud of a flower, began to spread out, to open up as the old folks filed down the fountain's ramps onto the city streets. They were replaced by young couples and groups of boys and girls who talked to each other from a distance but did not mix. So much like religious children, he thought. In a way, we are all the same. Dov Binyamin suddenly felt overwhelmed. He was startled to find himself in Tel Aviv, already involved in the act of searching out a harlot. Instead of home in his chair by the balcony, worrying over whether to take the Rebbe's advice at all, he walked back toward his car. A lone cab driver leaned up against the front door of his Mercedes, smoking. Dov Binyamin approached him, the heat of his feet inside his shoes becoming more oppressive with every step. Forgive me, Dov Binyamin said. The cab driver, his chest hair sticking out of the collar of his T-shirt in tufts, ground out the cigarette and opened the passenger door. Need a ride, Rabbi? I'm not a rabbi. And you don't need a ride? Dov Binyamin adjusted his hat. No, actually, no. The cab driver lit another cigarette, flourishing his Zippo impressively. Dove took notice, though he was not especially impressed. I'm looking for a prostitute. The cab driver coughed and clasped a hand to his chest. Do I look like a prostitute? No, you misunderstand. Dov Binyamin wondered if he should turn and run away. A female prostitute. What's her name? No name, any name. Well, you're a taxi driver. You must know where are such women. The taxi driver slapped the hood of his car and said, "Ha!" Which Dov took to be laughter. Another cab pulled up on Dov's other side. What's happening? The second driver called. Nothing. The rabbi here wants to know where to find a friend. Thinks it's a cab driver's responsibility to direct him. What, do we work for the Ministry of Tourism? The second driver asked. No, I just thought, Dov Binyamin said. His voice was high and cracking. It seemed to elicit pity in the second driver. There's a cash machine back at Dizengoff. But prostitutes at the bank? No, not at the bank, but the service isn't free. Dov blushed under his beard. Up by the train station in Ramat Gan, at the row of bus stops. All those pretty ladies aren't waiting for the bus to Haifa. This from the first driver, who again slapped the hood of his car and said, "Ha!" The first time passed, he did not stop. Driving by the women at high speed and taking the curves around the cement island so that his wheels screeched and he could smell the burning rubber. Dov Binyamin slowed down, trying to maintain control of himself and the car, afraid that he had already drawn too much attention his way. The steering wheel began to vibrate in Dov's shaking hands. The Rebbe had given him permission, had instructed him. Was not the Rebbe's heter valid? This is what Dov Binyamin told his hands. But they continued to tremble in protest. On his second time past, a woman approached the passenger door. She wore a matching shirt and pants. The outfit clung tightly, and Dov could see the full form of her body. Such immodesty. She tapped at the window. Dov Binyamin reached over to roll it down. Flustered, he knocked the gear shift and the car lurched forward. Applying the parking brake, he opened the window the rest of the way. "Close your lights," she instructed him. "We don't need to be on stage out here." "Sorry," he said, shutting off the lights. He was comforted by the error, not wanting the woman to think he was the kind of man who employed prostitutes on a regular basis. "You interested in some action?" "Me?" "Oh, a shy one," she said. She leaned through the window, and Dov Binyamin looked away from her large breasts. "Is this your first time?" "Don't worry. I'll be gentle. I know how to treat a black hat." Dov Binyamin felt the full weight of what he was doing. He was giving a bad name to all Hasidim. It was a sin against God's name. The urge to drive off, to race back to Jerusalem, and the silence of his wife came over Dov Binyamin. He concentrated on his dispensation. "What would you know from black hats?" he said. "Plenty," she said. And then, leaning in farther, "Actually, you look familiar." Dov Binyamin seized up, only to begin shaking twice as hard. He shifted into first and gave the car some gas. The prostitute barely got clear of the window. When it seemed as if he wouldn't be able to find a suitable match, a strong-looking young woman stepped out of the darkness. "Good evening," he said. She did not answer or ask any questions or smile. She opened the passenger door and sat down. "What do you think you're doing? Saving you the trouble of driving around until the sun comes up?" She was American. He could hear it. but she spoke beautiful Hebrew, sweet and strong as her step. Dov Binyamin turned on his headlights and again bumped the gear shift so that the car jumped. "Settle down there, Tiger," she said. "The hard part's over. All the rest of the work is mine." The room was in an unlicensed hostel. It had its own entrance. There was no furniture other than a double bed and three singles. The only lamp stood next to the door. The prostitute sat on the big bed with her legs curled underneath her. She said her name was Devorah. "Like the prophetess," Dov Binyamin said. "Exactly," Devorah said. "But I can only see into the immediate future. Still, it is a rare gift with which to have been endowed." Dov shifted his weight from foot to foot. He stood next to the large bed, unable to bring himself to bend his knees. "Not really," she said. "All my clients already know what's in store." She was fiery, this one. And their conversation served to warm up the parts of Dov the heat wave had not touched. The desire that had been building in Dov over the many months so filled his body that he was surprised his skin didn't burst from the pressure. He tossed his hat onto the opposite single, hoping to appear at ease, as sure of himself as the hairy-chested cab driver with his cigarettes. The hat landed brim side down. Dov's muscles twitched reflexively, though he did not flip it onto its crown. "Wouldn't you rather make your living as a prophetess?" he asked. "Well, of course. Prophesying's a piece of cake. You don't have to primp all day for it. And it's much easier on the back. No wear and tear. And it's better for you, too. At least you'd leave with something in the morning." She took out one of her earrings, then, as an afterthought, put it back in. "Doesn't matter anyway. There's no money in it. They pay me to do everything except look into the future." "I'll be the first then," he said, starting to feel almost comfortable. "Tell me what you see." She closed her eyes and tilted her head so that her lips began to part, this in the style of those who peer into other realms. "I predict that this is the first time you've done such a thing." "Well, that is not a prophecy, it's a guess." Dov Binyamin cleared his throat and wiggled his toes against the tops of his shoes. "What else do you predict?" She massaged her temples and held back a naughty grin. "That you will, for once, get properly laid." But this was too much for Dov Binyamin. Boiling in the heat and his shame, he motioned toward his hat. Devorah took his hand. "Forgive me," she said. "I didn't mean to be crude." Her fingers were tan and thin, more delicate than Chava's. How strange it was to see strange fingers against the whiteness of his own. "Excluding the affections of my mother, blessed be her memory, this is the first time I have been touched by a woman that is not my wife." She released her grasp and, before he had time to step away, reached out for him again, this time more firmly, as if shaking on a deal. Devorah raised herself up and straightened a leg, displayed it for a moment, and then let it dangle over the side of the bed. Dov admired the leg and the fingers resting against his palm. "Why are we here together?" she asked. She was not mocking him. Devorah pulled at the hand, and he sat at her side. "To relieve my unbearable urges, so that my wife will be able to love me again." Devorah raised her eyebrows and pursed her lips. "You come to me for your wife's sake?" "Yes." "You're a very dedicated husband." She gave him a smile that said, "You won't go through with it." The smile lingered, and then he saw that it said something completely different, something irresistible. And he wondered, as a shiver ran from the trunk of his body out to the hand she held, if what they say about American women is true. Dove walked toward the door, not to leave, but to shut off the lamp. 1 minute, Devorah said, reaching back and removing a condom from a tiny pocket, no more than a slit in the smooth black fabric of her pants. Dov Binyamin knew what it was and waved it away. "Am I really your second?" she asked. Dov heard more in the question than was intended. He heard a flirtation. He heard a woman who treated the act of being second as if it were special. He was sad for her, wondering if she had ever been anyone's first. He did not answer out loud, but instead nodded, affirming. Devorah pouted as she decided, the prophylactic held between two fingers like a quarter poised at the mouth of a jukebox. Dove switched off the light and took a half step toward the bed. He stroked at the darkness, moving forward until he found her hair, soft, alive, without any of the worked-over stiffness of Chava's wigs. "My God," he said, snatching back his hand as if he had been stung. It was too late, though. That he already knew. The hunger had flooded his whole self. His heart was swollen with it, pumping so loudly and with such strength that it overpowered whatever sense he might have had. For whom then, he wondered, was he putting on, in darkness, such a bashful show? He reached out again and stroked her hair, shaking but sure of his intent. With his other arm, the weaker arm to which he bound every morning his tefillin, the arm closer to the violent force of his heart, he searched for her hand. Dove found it and took hold of it, first roughly as if desperate, and then he held it lightly, delicately, as if it were made of blown glass, a goblet from which, with ceremony, he wished to drink. Bringing it toward his mouth, he began to speak. "It is a sin to spill seed in vain," he said. And Devorah let the condom fall at the sound of his words. Dov Binyamin was at work on Monday, and he was home as usual on Monday night. There was no desire to slip out of the apartment during the long hours when he could not sleep, no temptation when making a delivery and remote to turn the car in the direction of Tel Aviv. Dov Binyamin felt, along with a guilt that he could not shake, a sense of relief. He knew that he could never be with another woman again. And if it were possible to heap on himself all the sexual urges of the past months, if he could undo the single night with the prostitute to restore his unadulterated fidelity, he would have them tenfold. From that night of indulgence, he found the strength to wait a lifetime for Chava's attentions, if that need be. When Chava Bela entered the dining room, Dov Binyamin would move into the kitchen. When she entered the bedroom, he would close his eyes and feign sleep. He would lie in the dark and silently love his wife. And never coming to a conclusion, he would rethink the wisdom of the Rebbe's advice. He would picture the hairy arm of the cab driver as he slapped the hood of his taxi. And he would chide himself. Never, never would he accuse his wife of faking impurity. For was it not the greater sin for him to pretend to be pure? It was only a number of days from that Sunday night that Chava Bela began to talk to her husband with affection. Soon after, she touched him on the shoulder while handing him a platter of kashavarnishkas. He placed it on the table and ate in silence. As she served dessert, levelish, his favorite, Dov's guilt took on a physical form. What else could it be? What else but guilt would strike a man so obviously? It began as a concentrated smoldering that flushed the whole of his body. Quickly intensifying, it left him almost feverish. He would excuse himself from meals and sneak out of bed. At work, frightened and in ever-increasing pain, he ran from customers to examine himself in the bathroom. Dov Binyamin knew he was suffering from something more than shame. But maybe it was a trial, a test of which the Rebbe had not warned him. For as his discomfort increased, so did Chava's attentions. On her way out of the shower, she let her towel drop in front of him, stepping away from it as if she hadn't noticed, like some Victorian woman waiting for a gentleman to return her hanky with a bow. She dressed slowly, self-consciously, omitting her undergarments and looking to Dov to remind her. He ignored it all, feeling the weight of his heart, no longer pumping as if to burst, but just as large, the blood stagnant and heavy. Chava began to linger in doorways so that he would be forced to brush against her as he passed. Her passion was torturous to Dov, forced to keep his own hidden inside. Once, without any of the protocol with which they had tempered their lives, she came at the subject head on. "Are you such a small..."